those themes and begin to go through the book and track, you know, say take one of the themes and then like go through the book and see if you can track relevant passages, you know, three or four relevant passages that you think sort of speak to each of those themes or speak to one of the themes even. And then we can, you know, begin to discuss or something, so we can begin to discuss how they work from there. I don't think the list of themes is up yet, so I'll make sure the list of themes is up before the start of next week. Okay, chapter 3 of Nietzsche and philosophy, chapter 2. And I asked you to concentrate on sections 2, 3, 8, 9, 10 and 11. So hopefully you've at least had a look at those sections. For those of you who are interested, chapter 3 you will find is the core of the third chapter in Difference and Repetition. In that particular book it's called The Image of Thought. It's not the same by any means. There's a lot of differences. In fact, if you, you know, you wouldn't necessarily recognise them as being in any sense related if you were just to sort of read them on a cursory level. But there are enormous parallels between what's going on in this chapter and what's going on in chapter 3 of Difference and Repetition, which is called The Image of Thought. And I mean, the core of this idea that Deleuze wants to develop from Nietzsche with regard to critique is related to Kant, as you should obviously be aware. So who knows what critique, I mean, you've done your Kant, some of you, who knows what critique is meant to mean for Kant?
Is it where you break it down to look at the bits that you can be certain about? And so you can just sort of chuck out all the stuff which you can't be certain about and concentrate on working on what you can deal with.
To a certain extent, that makes sense, yes. I mean, who's done the Kant thing last term? Yeah? And so what definitions were you given of critique as a practice? Any definitions at all? Wasn't an issue that you discussed?
I don't recall it coming
out. Okay.
Is it a self-reflexive move? A move, like, a view of itself?
Exactly. I think that's beginning to be a little bit closer. Critique is something that explores the limits of a domain, fundamentally. A critique is not a criticism. Okay, criticism is entirely distinct from critique, and for a very fundamental reason, which is criticism takes an object as external to it and uses a set of criteria that are not necessarily shared by the object of criticism. So I can critique, for example, the policy of the Conservative Party or the Labour Party without being a member of either or sharing any of their values, and I can offer criticism. The criticism is grounded on my own set of values. Critique does not import a set of values into the object it is critiquing. It begins from the values the object itself establishes. Okay, so this is why it's called immanent. Within, from within. So we look for things like the limits of a set of values or a set of criteria. We look for internal inconsistencies, internal contradictions or paradoxes, and we look for the mechanisms as well. It's a technique developed by Kant originally, which is how I'm surprised that it wasn't sort of focused upon as a sort of methodological innovation in the sense that Kant introduces. It's a technique that's fundamentally developed by Kant. It doesn't really exist before Kant. It's not something that, you know, has a sort of transcendent history in philosophy. Everyone did critique. That's not really the case. It's something that derives from Kant. It refers to Kant. It's a work that should make you think of Kant when you come across it inside a philosophical text. And it's based around this idea of, as I say, immanent values as the ground from which you work, looking for internal consistencies, and also this idea of the mechanism. So for Kant in particular, that was what would be the central mechanism that he recognised or he asserted as existing within cognition.
Reason.
Reason was one aspect of the mechanism. The faculties. Okay, that we have faculties. That again is something that doesn't really operate in the same way prior to Kant as post-Kant. And in fact, even post-Kant faculties will soon sort of disappear. But for Kant, cognition is a mechanism of faculties interacting with each other. So we don't have one cognition structure. We have a cognition structure that's made up of various faculties. So what are three of those faculties that he outlines, the three sort of core ones? Fuck me, have you actually done any Kant here? Come on. Faculties, not categories.
Time and space. Time and space.
No, again, categories, not faculties.
The intuition, the understanding and the imagination.
Yeah, that would be three of them. Intuition, understanding and reason would be sort of the core ones.
Reason?
Reason and understanding are not the same, no? That was clear?
Yeah. Okay.
Intuition is sensibility, you might think of, you know, sensation or, you know, that stuff without which our concepts are empty. All that sort of crap, remember? Right, we at least know the fucking motto of Kant. Intuitions without concepts are blind, concepts without intuitions are empty. So we've got intuitions, which are these sort of sensibility, feelings, you know, that sort of, I mean, they're about as vague to define as the word intuition is vague to use, really. Understanding, which is where the categories, the concepts are located. And reason, which is where the ideas are located. And what three core ideas does Kant identify?
Is that in the first critique? In the first part of the critique? The reason, the ideas. I think the ideas comes later, doesn't it, in a dialectic?
It does, but you've done Kant, so I'm assuming you've encountered the ideas. No? God, world and self. Fuck me. Okay.
Do you mean the causality stuff? The rules?
No, ideas without which we cannot conceive the world.
Problems of metaphysics.
Yeah, those type of things. Ideas without which we cannot conceive the world. So we can't even think of the world for Kant without the ideas of God, world and soul. And this now gets to the important point. What is the main problem in the mechanism that Kant identifies?
Talking about idealism and how we come to know an object in itself?
No, that's a sort of result. It's more a result of what he wants to identify. Why do we go wrong, Kant thinks? Is it just because we're stupid? Our sensibility doesn't quite get enough?
Because we don't know how to apply concepts to objects and experience. We don't know how to properly apply concepts to
experience. Right, but what, yeah, that's exactly right. We go wrong because we don't know how to apply concepts to objects of experience. Why do we go wrong in that way? What drives that error? This is very important, actually, for Kant. It's reason that drives that error. Reason is what makes us go wrong in our reasoning. This is absolutely the most fundamental insight that Kant has. It is reason, not sensibility, not the understanding in itself or our concepts. It's reason that makes us go wrong in our reasoning. Because the ideas of reason are infinite. They inherently produce a problem when it encounters the finitude or the finite nature, the limited nature, if you prefer, in terms of everyday language, of our cognition. Now, this structure in which reason makes us go wrong in our reasoning, because of this sort of conflict between the infinite nature of the ideas, God, world, soul, and the way in which they then structure or organise the mechanism of the understanding and intuition relating to each other, the understanding and intuition don't just sort of relate to each other through the imagination in sort of a random way. They're sort of structured through the ideas of reason. They're driven, given a force or given a dynamic or a direction through the ideas of reason. Reason makes us go wrong in this way because of this infinite nature of the ideas in relationship to the finite nature of our cognition. This is what Kant calls transcendental illusion. Okay? Cognition is subject to a transcendental illusion. In order to uncover that transcendental illusion and correct it, he produces things like the analytic and the dialectic, right? In order to show how, if we actually, you know, separate our intuitions and concepts, we can then, as it were, recombine them accurately and more succinctly, because we know now what limits we must maintain this recombination within. It's not just that we combine concepts and intuitions in Kant. That's entirely facile reading of Kant. It's entirely trite, entirely trivial, meaningless crap. The reason that it's interesting is because he's basically saying there is a way in which you can combine concepts and intuitions correctly, overcoming the illusion that's inbuilt to cognition itself. That's what's crucial about Kant. Not, you know, there's concepts and there's intuitions. I mean, for God's sake, even Hume thought this to a certain extent. I mean, this is really nothing new, nothing interesting. Plato thought this. It is really the sort of relationship of the, you know, what's called the one-all debate. Which is not 1-1. You know, West Ham 1, Chelsea 1. It's not 1-all something. It's the one, the all. The object in its relationship to the concepts, the particular in its relationship to the general, all those type of ways of phrasing things. So that's part of the one-all debate, in a sense, concepts, intuitions and their relationships. What's interesting about Kant is that he gives us a way in which we can know whether we're doing it correctly, because he then, as it were, shows us the limits, how far we can go. And the crucial question that he offers us in order to sort of operate that finding of the limits is not what is it I know, but how does he change that question? Kant wouldn't ask what is it I know. What would he ask? Closer. This is going to be Deleuze. It's shifting to Deleuze here. What is it that I can know? Not what is it I know, but what is it I can know? What is it possible for me to know? Which is how we then get Rachel to the idealism thing. What is it possible for me to know? Well, you know, for Kant, one of the things that arises is that it's not possible for me to know the objects in themselves, the noumena. But that noumena thing comes precisely from this, what is it possible for me to know? So in the same way that Descartes, for example, starts with, well, what is it possible for me to doubt? I can get the malicious demon in and I can show you that I can doubt pretty much bloody everything. Kant goes, well, what is it possible for me to know? This is the absolute crucial move, and it's a response to the problem of transcendental illusion. So in other words, reason produces errors in our reasoning. This is what's called transcendental illusion. In order to uncover the transcendental illusion and correct it, we need to address not what is it I know, but what is it possible for me to know. How does the mechanism work such that I can find the limits of what I can know and make sure that I don't go beyond those limits? Now, what's crucial, and the reason I've sort of gone over this bit of Kant, is what I really want you to note here is that critique grounds itself on a change in the question. It changes the question that we ask. It changes the question from what is it I know. The empirical or the rational question is often derived from what is it I know, how is it I know. And that's the sort of the rational empirical debate. What is it I know, how is it I know? And it changes that question to what is it I can know? How is it I can know? The can, the possible, is the crucial move, the crucial change in the question. So this is what's important, is that Kant's already changed the question. That's the move Kant makes with critique, to change the question. And as Felicity's already sort of indicated, one of the first things that Deleuze is trying to suggest in this chapter is that this is absolutely central to Nietzsche as well. Nietzsche makes a further move in the same direction. Right? In other words, imminent to cognition, reason, values themselves. How is it I value is not what Nietzsche asks. It's what type of values do people create? Who is it, he then says, that creates these values? That's how I will answer the question, how, you know, what type of values do people create? I won't assume, in other words, that there is one type of person, one type of method for the creation of values. I will ask, who is it that creates these particular values? Now, Kant's question is producing a very, very broad, very universal, very general structure, which is going to limit absolutely everything. So for Kant and for Kantians, you know, they just rule out of court as meaningless and naive, whole swathes of conversation, whole swathes of philosophical activity. They think it's just irrelevant, you know, incapable of understanding itself, naive, and should therefore be, in a sense, ignored. And they do this by producing this very, very broad, overarching structure, the conditions of possible experience. You know, that's going to be what they, you know, how, you know, what is it possible for me to know? Well, this is going to be given an answer by the conditions of possible experience. Now, what Nietzsche is doing is he's going in the exact opposite direction. He's not trying to produce extremely broad universal answers. He's trying to produce phenomenally particular answers. Answers that, in a sense, almost don't go beyond one single person. Almost. They do, but they almost don't. Which is why, obviously, he's very, very intimately connected with the same moves that Kierkegaard makes. This existentialist move of, as it were, rejecting the system, referring to the concrete. So this notion of which direction they're going and where they're looking for the answers is fundamental. It's very broad and it's very difficult to sort of pin those things down, but it's important to try and get a sense that they're moving in very different directions. So in sections 2 and 3 we find this shift most clearly noticed. The form of the question of Nietzsche, section 2, which then goes on to Nietzsche's method in section 3. So this is what Deleuze sort of brings to the fore. He brings this relationship of Nietzsche and Kant to the fore. The background that I've just given you on Kant is sort of not necessarily here, but it's background that enables you should be able to sort of contextualise now what's going on. If you were to sort of write that background in regard to Kant, you could write a sort of parallel background in regard to Nietzsche, but going in this opposite direction. So the shifting question is the crucial thing to remember. For Kant, he shifts the question and produces this universal structure within which everything is then sort of limited. For Nietzsche, he wants to shift the question as well, but in a different direction, towards people who actually are creating values. Any questions on this so far? Anyone got something they want to bring up that they makes sense or doesn't, it's not been covered so far in terms of sections 2 and 3?
Maybe just the dramatisation of the will, and they sort of brought in the dramatisation aspect. Maybe just...
Okay, can you point me to...
It comes in sort of halfway down, just after 3.
73, yeah? Page 73?
Page 73, yeah.
Okay. Okay, let's. I think that is important. Let's get to that in a moment. We'll make sure we come to that in a moment. But yes, okay, we'll come to that because that's probably going to be a way of us trying to sort of, in a sense, getting a formula almost.
Yeah. On page 72, in the second section, it says essence is always sense and value. How is he seeing sense here? What does he mean by sense?
How is he seeing sense there? Well, that's I mean, I'm not entirely sure how you'd answer that. He sees sense, I suppose, in terms of, I mean, in French the word sense has this connotation of direction, so the way in which you're going. You know, what sort of goals you have and what aims you have implicit in the sense.
So teleological.
But I think, no, I don't think it is teleological. I mean, essence is always sense and value. I mean, why would essence normally not be sense and value? What would an essence usually be?
Fundamental stationary thing.
Yeah, right. And how would we give the essence of something?
By saying what remains the same in it.
Yeah, right. Okay. Essence would be that which remains the same in it, and it would be something like. I mean, can anyone think of an example that they might want to give if they were giving an essay? The essence of. Okay, I mean, Aristotle's definition of the human as the rational animal is a definition of essence. You know, or as a political animal, zoon politikon. And so an essence, yes? We might define water as H2O, and in doing so, we are not, you know, doing anything other than, in a sense, trying to give it an essence. Obviously, if we define water as H2O, what we've extracted from that definition is the fact that water is necessary to live for the human being. Water is an absolutely fundamental aspect of the ecosystem. Water is the fluid that dissolves, all these type of things. These things we're now seeing as no longer relevant because we could say other things do this, and we're defining, you know, water as essentially H2O. And these other things that it does are not really water. They're just, you know, capacities that it might have based upon the essence. So essence is taken as some sort of core. Yeah? Sense and value, are they, how would they be sort of then, you know, distinct from or different from that?
They're imposed from outside the thing on it, you know, they're not sort of properties of the thing, they're kind of properties of the way you view something.
Yeah, okay, I think that, yes, I mean, I think you're on the right track, actually, but I would hesitate, I mean, with Nietzsche at least, to say that they're imposed from the outside. But what you're right in saying is that they are properties that we would think of as relational. Yeah, I mean, the sense of something is often relative to a situation. The value of something is often relative to a situation. So, you know, wood might be said to have no value, but its essence is to be a certain type of thing, you know, or water, let's say, has no value, but its essence is H2O, whereas its value is for the human, you know, with it 3 days without it and you die, for, you know, chemistry, some sort of soluble, you know, base, etc., etc. So, I mean, value and essence exactly are sort of relational properties. Not as I wouldn't, you know, as I say, I wouldn't say imposed from the outside, because that's going to be precisely what will to power, as it were, rejects. But they are relational. Essences are, in a sense, and this is what when Eliot was saying they're static, we might want to say something more like they're positional, or they're, you know, they're isolated, as it were. The essence is an isolated definition of an object. So it stands alone, it's there for eternity, it's always the case. No matter what happens to the water, whether I boil it or whether I freeze it, the essence of water doesn't change. The essence of water is always the same. Whereas when things are in a relationship and are, as it were, only what they are because of the relationship they're in, then its essence is changeable. It doesn't really have, you know, we might say, an essence. It only has this sense and value. So that's actually a very compressed and very, you know, that, I mean, when you find a sentence like that, the way to look at it is to go, well, who would, I mean, and this is following on Nietzsche's method, according to Deleuze, who would agree with that statement and who wouldn't? Mm-hmm. Which philosopher wouldn't agree with that statement and which wouldn't? What does this statement mean for, you know, how I would write an essence out, and, you know, how different is that from another definition? So that's what you need to do when you encounter a sort of a curious, compressed phrase like that. Essence is always sense of value. And as you can see, there's no straight argument given for it. There's not an argument here that goes, essence is traditionally defined as this, and now I'm going to say it's now defined as that. There's no argument for it. And this is also a deliberate way in which Deleuze writes. He writes quite often with a series of claims. A series of claims are constructed in a way that produces an argument in inverted commas, an argument that you have to reconstruct. You can do two things. You can either A, just accept it and think, okay, that's right, I'll just carry on with this and I'll repeat it, or B, you can think, why is it that way and not another way, which is the more intelligent way of trying to read it. He's trying to present you with a way, quite often as a philosopher, that's so incongruous, which is one of the difficulties of reading Deleuze, is that you sort of need almost to read Deleuze with a sort of philosophical background, but he presents you with statements that are so, in a sense, incongruous or plainly wrong, you know, traditionally seen as the exact, you know, opposite of what we would normally accept, that you then have to think, well, why is it that way? Why would you think this? What implications does this have? How is this different from? So when you're trying to read Deleuze, it's one of the ways, it's one of the difficulties, is you're traditionally taught to read these sort of rather boring linear narrative arguments. So they sort of go from point A to point B and guide you like sort of tom-tom, you know, so that you don't need to worry about where you are anymore, you just follow your GPS system, you know, it's a bit like that. None of that actually helps you think, of course.
He's very biased, though. He's always pushing towards one direction.
Extremely biased.
Very.
Extremely biased. If anyone ever thinks that this is a interpretation of what Nietzsche actually says, well, I suggest you go and read Nietzsche again. And you probably won't find many other interpreters anywhere near Deleuze. He's extremely biased, as you want to put it. Or we could say, I'd probably prefer the words of idiosyncratic.
Just a tad.
Idiosyncratic, specifically in relationship to the gregarious nature of Nietzsche interpretation.
Just fair enough.
So, questions. What type of questions do we ask? Why would it matter? Is it obvious why it matters?
You mean the posing of a question, a particular question?
Hmm.
It matters on the outcome, doesn't it? On the answer that you're... It matters on the search for the answer, doesn't it? The way you particularly...
Okay, so that much, presumably, we're all sort of happy with, you know, depending on the question you ask, sort of organises the way in which you're going to answer it, yeah? Who started in philosophy asking what is?
Socrates.
Socrates. So from the very first moment in which philosophy traditionally began, it begins from asking the question, what is? Did Heraclitus, or I don't know if any of you ever bothered to read Heraclitus or Parmenides, but did either, or even Zeno, but did any of them ask what is?
No, not from what it sounds like, it
is. You'll find that you're almost... Parmenides and Heraclitus, Parmenides in particular, would be almost incomprehensible to you. There's no questions in Parmenides. It's just poetry. And literally, poetry. It's just a series of poetic lines and statements about being and non-being and the path and this path and two paths and that path and going up one way and down another. And it's just, you know, there's not really questions in Parmenides in that sense.
Heraclitus like that as well.
And Heraclitus is very much the same. There's not really questions.
Just fragments.
Yeah, there's not that sort of strange way of going, what's this and what's that and how are we going to work out what this and what that is. It's Socrates that begins by asking what is. And what sort of things does he ask after? Because he doesn't ask what's your name.
Justice.
Justice is one. Another one?
I said ethics, but that's
cool. Yeah.
Beautiful.
What is the beautiful was another one.
Values, of course, your values. What is beauty, what is justice, things like that.
Yeah, and what is truth? So he's asking these sort of general, fundamental questions. Now, how would you answer that question?
Well, they all try by giving examples of it.
Right. They all try by giving examples. And what does he do each time they give an example?
Tell them to go away.
Hmm?
Tell them to go away.
I don't just want an example. I want a definition. Example.
Right. Well, he essentially says, you know, he shows that this example is not just... in itself, or something, or it's not true in itself, or it's not, you know, in this situation you can see how this wouldn't be justice, or blah blah, you know, he sort of demolishes every example produced. So the technique of Socrates is to go, what is justice? The respondents go, well, justice is, you know, the situation in Sparta, or the situation in Athens, or this particular way, or that particular way, might is right, etc. And each time he goes, well, you know, this doesn't work here, and therefore it's not justice. Now, the assumption is that justice or truth or beauty is some overarching all. Okay, this is where we get this one all thing from. It's an overarching all in which every example participates. And only by examining the examples and how they, in a sense, fail to match up, do we begin to extract, to abstract from the examples, a general concept of truth or beauty or justice. This general concept will then be the essence, that's what the concept will aim at, the essence of truth or beauty. Now Plato turns this into the forms. This is not Socrates. Socrates never, ever, 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 ever believed in the forms. It's just plainly stupid, if you look at the way Socrates works, that he could ever believe in the forms. It's not even clear that Socrates thinks that philosophy aims at that. He just thinks his question makes you sort of capable of fucking people's ideas up. You know, that's all he says he is. He's a fly on the horse of Athens. He's a fly on the horse's ass. He's not even trying to find something. It's in the end really Plato that goes for the forms, the essences, and he sort of codifies. He makes Socrates' method of provocative questioning a method of producing knowledge. And it's this moment between Socrates and Plato, the shift between Socrates and Plato, that's fundamental to Deleuze and also fundamental to Nietzsche. They think there's something very interesting about what Socrates is doing, and in that sense they're philosophers. They think they're heirs to Socrates, like all philosophers think we're the heirs to Socrates. But it's the moment that Plato does something with it and takes it in a particular direction of trying to produce knowledge, codified, structured, transmissible information as knowledge. In other words, you know, the information is what we've defined the essence of justice to be. Information we can then just pass on. We can, like, consume it. Now, we don't need to think about it anymore. Socrates wasn't doing that, obviously. He was plainly not doing that. The early dialogues are much more different to something ridiculously like the Fascist Republic. That just appalling text that nobody should ever take seriously. And, you know, that's Plato. The Republic is Plato down to the line, the laws, all those type of things. Socrates is a completely different kettle of fish. So the question can do two things, we know here. It can structure what answers we give, but it can also not be trying to produce answers. The question can be trying to unsettle, to remove already accepted answers. Okay, and that bit we don't notice so much. To ask a question, particularly for philosophy, is more often than not to try and remove people's answers than it is to give them answers. In fact, that's generally speaking the only positive thing philosophy can do, and the reason it's quite widely disliked by a lot of people. When you engage in philosophy with them, they want you to give them answers, and when you start actually engaging in philosophy and just criticising, breaking down and disrupting the answers they've already got, they obviously don't like it, but then no one does. And, you know, I don't like it any more than anyone else. You know, it's uncomfortable when people do that to you, which is the whole point. But it can do two things. So it can give answers, but it can also break answers, unsettle answers. Okay, so that's what questions can do. What is questions can do that? That's in a sense that difference between Socrates and Plato. So why then change answers? Change the questions, rather. Let's look right at the section, start of section two. Metaphysics formulated the question of essence in the form what is. Okay, so this is what we're talking about. We have perhaps picked up the habit of considering that this question is obvious. In fact, we owe it to Socrates and Plato. This is what I've just been discussing. We must go back to Plato to see how far the question what is presupposes a particular way of thinking. Plato asks what is beauty, what is justice, etc. He wants to oppose this form of the question to all other forms. He sometimes sets Socrates against very young men, sometimes against stubborn old men, sometimes against famous sophists. They all seem to produce the same form of reply, citing the one that is just, the one that is beautiful, a young virgin, a mare, a cooking pot. Socrates triumphs. One does not reply to the question, what is beauty, by citing the one that is beautiful. So we get the distinction, dear to Plato. Note the emphasis on how Plato is being given responsibility for this, and Socrates is like being almost manipulated by Plato. So we get the distinction, dear to Plato, between beautiful things, which are only beautiful, for example, accidentally and according to becoming, and beauty, which is nothing but beautiful, necessarily beautiful, the one that is beautiful in its being and essence. This is why in Plato the opposition of essence and appearance, of being and becoming, depends primarily on a mode of questioning a form of question. Okay, so this is the point that you need to note. What is crucial in a sense conceptually for Deleuze is not, in a sense, you know, the what is question just generally, as we said, it can be a demolishing question as it is in Socrates. What is crucial is the way Plato uses it to establish a distinction between appearance and reality. Being and becoming. Reality is the being of something, appearance is merely the becoming of something. What we are doing when we are encountering the world is encountering appearances, becomings. Things change, things shift, things move, things change colour or age or height or taste or whatever. And, you know, none of that's really of interest. If we're interested in the truth, we're interested in this eternal being. And that's what we call an essence. So essence, appearance, reality, appearance, being, becoming, these are all, in a sense, the same type of word, same type of distinction. There's slight variations in the way in which you pose them. They can become quite crucial, but at the moment you don't need to worry too much about them. So that sentence, this is why in Plato the opposition of essence and appearance of being and becoming depends primarily on a mode of questioning, a form of question. Now, in shifting the form of question, one of the aims is to shift this dualism, to step aside from this dualism and to work again on the world. In a sense, not to have assumed this dualism of being and becoming, reality and appearance. And this is Deleuze, has he, a little bit later. It is less certain that the question, what is beauty, is not itself a blunder. He's not saying it is, he's just saying, well, maybe we should actually be careful about our questioning. It's not entirely clear that we're not already going wrong when we ask it. It is by no means certain that it is legitimate and well put, even and above all, as a way of discovering essence. Okay, so note here, he's not implying that we should just throw out notions of essence. He's not implying that we should, you know, just simply reject Plato's dualism. What he's trying to do is he's trying to caution us to step back and not assume too much. Not, as it were, go blindly into the, you know, investigation. Okay, so the next paragraph at the bottom of page 71, a quotation from Nietzsche. What is it, I cried out with curiosity. Which one is it, you ought to ask? Thus spoke Dionysus, then kept quiet in his own special way, that is to say, in an enticing way. Now, there's two things you should note in that sentence, or that quotation. What would you, which one would you pick out? Which two things would you like to pick out?
Which one?
Yeah, that's. I mean, that's the way in which the question is going to be changed, definitely. The which one is it, rather than what is it. But there's two things that are sort of, I think, sort of more interesting in that quotation that you ought to note, particularly in terms of your ability to develop a problem with what Deleuze is going to do and what he thinks Nietzsche's doing, criticism.
What role does Dionysus play in that quote?
It's the sort of character that's speaking. You know what I mean?
Doesn't it?
Dionysus is a character of becoming. It's like a, you know, he personifies the philosophy of becoming, as it were. Right. You ought to ask. This is a normative. As soon as someone says you ought to do this, you ought to be able to ask, according to good philosophical practice, why ought I to do this? What criteria do you have that I should rather do this than that? So there is a certain normativity implied in this. In other words, despite Nietzsche's, you know, professed amorality, there is a morality here. This is not an is, after all, this is an ought. So it's a sort of value. If you remember your is-ought distinction and the problems of getting from is to ought and all this sort of stuff, which you must really have encountered at some point. Right, good, good. Okay, so that ought. Whenever you see the word ought being used by a philosopher, you need to sort of think, well, it's not an is, it's an ought. So what's going on here? There's a value that might be a problem. What's the criteria? How do I judge this? Give me the values that enable me to be right or wrong. So that's the first thing you should note. That there may be, in what Deleuze is going to say in what, about Nietzsche in this different question, there may be a normative problem. How will he be able to justify that you ought to do X rather than Y? What will be the criteria of the normative judgment? The second issue, what is it, I cried out with curiosity, which one is it you ought to ask? Thus spoke Dionysus, then kept quiet in his own special way. He offers no immediate response. He does not offer an answer. He merely challenges your question, the question you ask. This again will become quite important. There is a sense in which that's going to be one of the ways that the normativity can be understood. Why ought you to ask this question? One of the responses we might say is that the criteria is these type of questions promote autonomous thought. They promote idiosyncratic thought. They promote, as it were, subjects having their own power rather than being given an answer. That might be a way in which we can develop a criteria. That criteria would then be sort of boiled down to something like being capable of independent thinking is better than not being capable of independent thinking. That which promotes it is therefore better than that which demotes it. That itself is not necessarily as obvious as you might like to think.
Is there anything like that distinction between so if you're like kind of too dumb to not get the hint, then you know we don't want you to understand.
Yeah, and, exactly. Very much with
you've
Nietzsche.
You've got to work for it if you want it.
Yeah, very much with Nietzsche. I mean, when you're reading Nietzsche, there's a whole series of things in it that are basically, if you're too dumb to not get the hint, then you're fucked, and I don't care. And in fact, there are points in Nietzsche that are even worse than that. There are points in Nietzsche that are deliberate traps.
Specifically, are elitist.
There are points in Nietzsche where if you read it and you take it literally and you don't connect it to other things that are said and you don't take the hints, not only do you not get it, you get it completely wrong and you will end up looking like his sister, you know what I mean? And promoting some very strange shit. That's basically what happens to his sister in a way. She's trapped by her brother into reading him in a way that, you know, just showed how, you know, bigoted, stupid, and what type she was. Mm. So the text is in a way meant to reveal you. It's quite capable of doing that. It's quite capable of doing that even now to people. You get a large number of, sort of students who encounter Nietzsche and then suddenly sort of start running around nihilistic, you know, with a nihilistic approach to the world. And it's like, just haven't got a clue, have you? You really haven't even read Nietzsche if you think nihilism is Nietzscheanism, because that's just absolutely not the case. It's completely the opposite. It's almost the only real enemy Nietzsche had was nihilism. Mm. It's like, you know, anyone who thinks Nietzsche is nihilistic because he removes an easy truth or an easy sense of good or an easy values judgment structure is just incapable of really reading Nietzsche. And of course, for those of us who encounter people like that, it's humorous. You don't trust them, you don't really want to do anything with them, you wouldn't, you know, offer them a job, you wouldn't want to sit down and have a pint with them unless they were buying, you know, and you could probably persuade them to buy you half a dozen pints for nothing and get drunk from their purse, you know, I mean, it's, you know, people you can manipulate, basically, because they're slave types. And that's what Nietzsche is supposedly, you know, meant to do. Now, that's not always... that's not always the case. There are texts that are more honest than that, but a lot of his texts are deliberate sort of mess-with-your-head type things.
I mean, the genealogy, he just has no principle for why one or the other, so that just leaves you at a loss. You're thinking, so what are you saying? You read the genealogy and you say, so what the hell are you telling me? You read it again and the same thing. He's like that. It's difficult.
Yes, he is. But that's sort of...
the whole point.
Yes, in a way that is partly the point. So anyway, let's just shift along. The shift is going to be to this different type of question. The shift is going to be to questions that ask about the one that is. Okay? Now, in page 72, you find a curious way of formulating this. The way in which you will ask this question... The question, what is it, is a way of establishing a sense seen from another point of view. Essence, being, is a perspectival reality and presupposes a plurality. Fundamentally, it is always the question, what is it for me? When we ask what beauty is, we ask from what standpoint things appear beautiful. And something which does not appear beautiful to us, from what standpoint would it become so? And for a particular thing, what are the forces which make or would make it beautiful by appropriating it? What are the other factors which yield to these, or on the contrary, resist them? The pluralist art does not deny essence. It makes it depend, in each case, on an affinity of phenomena and forces, on a coordination of force and will. The essence of thing is discovered in the force which possesses it and which is expressed in it. It is developed in the forces with affinity for this first one, endangered or destroyed by the forces which are opposed to it and which can take hold of it. Essence is always sense and value. And so the question, which one reverberates in and for all things, which forces, which will, this is the tragic question. At the deepest level, the whole of it is held out to Dionysus. For Dionysus is the god who hides and reveals himself. Dionysus is will. Dionysus is the one that. The question, which one finds its supreme instance in Dionysus or in the will to power? Dionysus, the will to power, is the one that answers it each time it is put. We should not ask which one wills, which one interprets, which one evaluates, for everywhere and always the will to power is the one that. Now you've probably got to look at this passage. It begins from this, like what looks like a pure opinion. What is it for me? Okay, so it looks like pure opinion. I'm not going to ask the question in terms of any general answer that everyone can share. I'm just going to say, what is it for me? But what it wants you to push towards is not what is it for you in an individualistic sense. It is what it is for you because of what it forces, because of what it produces, because of the response you are forced to have to it, even if that response is a non-response, even if you don't understand it or you're completely blank in front of it. In a sense, you've been forced into that silence. Now, what's meant to occur at this point is a sort of inversion, one of these reversal moments. In asking what is it for me, you encounter, like a doctor encounters a disease, the symptoms. This is why we're symptomatologists. And the symptoms are the symptoms of will to power. And it's will to power that then enables this question, what is it for me, to actually not be a question about individual opinion, but to be a question about how does this thing become a universal or a general question. You don't ask how does this thing become by asking that question. You ask how does it become for me? In doing that, I can begin to go, as it were, drill down into the becoming of an object, the becoming of an artwork or a value system or a political structure or a relationship or a table. Or, you know, you can begin to drill down from the particular to the general, rather than start from the general and then find which comes underneath it. But it's absolutely crucial that this is seen as some sort of drilling down. You don't just stop at opinion. You take your opinion to be something produced. So you encounter your opinion as a symptom. And you then try and diagnose what it's a symptom of. What forces is it a symptom of? This is why you become symptomatologists. Right? And in doing that, what you'll begin to do, they think, is be able to establish groupings. Certain people will behave in certain sorts of ways, other people will behave in other sorts of ways, because symptoms will be grouped in clusters, like we do in medicine when we group clusters of symptoms under the name of a syndrome. The difference between a syndrome and a disease is precisely that in a syndrome, we haven't pinpointed a specific etiology. of the disease structure. Okay, so we have a cluster of symptoms which seem to share a lot, but overlap a lot, but we haven't yet pinpointed exactly the etiology of the disease, and quite often syndromes will gradually break down as bits peel off from them, and there'll be specific diseases identified, and then there'll be like family resemblances between them, and there won't be syndromes anymore, but there'll be a series of diseases. This is how medicine operates, this is how doctors operate, this is how, as well, Nietzsche would think, artists operate. They are symptomatologists. And what he's trying to suggest is this is how philosophy should now operate. It should not operate in this bizarre pursuit of static essences, being. It needs to instead return to Heraclitus and becoming, and actually value that. And in order to do that, it will need to stop trying to look for fixed definitions and begin to drill down into the way in which things become. And it does this by symptomatology, by typology, and by genealogy. Okay, those are the three techniques that are to be replaced as the critique method. They're in section one. You can find them there. Those are the ones mentioned in section one. So they're on page 70. So symptomatology, typology, and genealogy. So we can, and he says at the end there on section 1, page 70, we can recognise the Nietzschean trinity of the philosophy of the future, the philosopher physician, the symptomatologist, the philosopher artist, the typologist, and the philosopher legislator, the genealogist. And it's the legislator that we'll come to after we've had a fag break. That's good.